Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This hour on the program, reflections on black history and the election of President Barack Obama. With civil rights historians Paul Ortiz and Hassan Kwame Jeffries, we'll look back at the historical antecedents of the Obama presidential campaign, including the 1980s presidential campaigns of the Reverend Jesse Jackson. We'll discuss the influence of prior social movements on Obama campaign strategy, and we'll look at the Obama campaign's message of change and inclusion as a continuation of the universalist message of the African-American civil rights movement. Back with us, Hassan Kwame Jeffries, assistant professor of history here at The Ohio State University. He's the author of the forthcoming book, Bloody Lowndes, that's Lowndes County in Alabama, Bloody Lowndes, Civil Rights and Black Power in Alabama's Black Belt. And Hassan, great to have you back.
Thank you very much, Fred.
Joining us, Paul Ortiz, Associate Professor of History and Director of the Oral History Program at the University of Florida. He's the author of Emancipation Betrayed, The Hidden History of Black Organizing and White Violence in Florida from Reconstruction to the Bloody Election of 1920. Welcome back, Paul Ortiz. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Fred. It's great to be back.
Good to have you here both. And we're at 614-292-8513. And you can email brief comments or questions to openline@wosu.org. Well, Paul, you know that some of the commentators have suggested that the Obama campaign strategies and tactics were brand new and something never seen before. But you suggest that it's borrowed, in fact, these tactics from some of the earlier social movement tactics, including labor and civil rights movements.
Yeah, exactly, Fred. There were new things that came out of the Obama campaign. There was a lot of youth involvement. There was a lot of, you know, the use of technology and the web. And, you know, but at the same time, Obama himself, if you look at his acceptance speech, one of the first people he mentioned by name was a woman by the name of Ann Nixon Cooper. Mm-hmm. And Ann Nixon Cooper is 106 years old. She cast her ballot for Obama. And I think what he was trying to do is he was trying to remind us that, yes, there was a lot of media emphasis on youth, but at the same time, we have to understand that people have been struggling and fighting for this moment for generations, if not centuries. And I think if you talk to a lot of the organizers who are involved in the Obama campaign, the people on the grassroots, you know, these were veterans of the civil rights movement, the labor movement, the women's movement, lesbian, gay, queer movements. A lot of them were very seasoned organizers who came out of these grassroots struggles. And you mentioned Reverend Jackson and those amazing presidential campaigns in 1984 and 1988, which brought together so many Americans from different demographic groups. I mean, we couldn't even imagine what happened on election night in 2008 without those antecedents.
Mm-hmm. So, Hassan, this inclusiveness of President Barack Obama, it's out of a long tradition of inclusiveness in terms of the African-American civil rights movement.
No, absolutely. Too often we think of the civil rights movement or the African-American struggle for freedom as strictly a struggle to gain rights specific to African Americans. But really, from the pre-emancipation period, when African Americans were struggling to secure their freedom from slavery, to abolish slavery, they were arguing and agitating for not just civil rights, but for human rights as well. I mean, so one, it was a combination of both civil and human rights, but they fought for these rights and argued and lobbied for these rights in very universalist terms. So they said not only should African Americans be free, but all people should be free. Not only should African Americans have the right to vote in the 50s and 60s, but all people, regardless of class, regardless of gender, should have full and equal access to the ballot. So it's interesting because the same sort of press coverage, if you will, of Obama saying, well, he sort of transcended race. And I'm sure we'll talk about that later on with this sort of universalist message. Mm-hmm. The reality is that it was the first time many in the media and many in the larger white American community had actually heard or listened to or picked up on the universalist message of the African-American freedom.
The message was there, but it hadn't been picked up on by the
wider
community.
Exactly. And so in that sense, if you want to talk about transcending race, for the first time, it was sort of an ear-opening. Sort of the larger American community heard this universalist message, but it was always there. It was never just about African-Americans achieving a particular place in society. It was really about equality for all people, no matter how long they've been here, no matter who they are, race, gender, or class.
Mm-hmm. So, Paul, yeah. A consistent message, huh?
I think so. And listening to Hassan speak, I'm thinking of a person like Frederick Douglass, who, you know, of course, started his life as a slave in the South and then fought this physical battle with his overseer and liberated himself and ended up being a great abolitionist, a friend of Abraham Lincoln, and a key kind of strategist in the American Civil War. Douglass never said, oh, I'm not a black man. He always, when he spoke, when he presented himself as a black man, as a former slave. But he used race to create this universal platform that Hassan is referring to, and he ends up in Ireland, you know, fighting on behalf of Irish emancipation, speaking on behalf of women's rights. But he used his experience as a black man, as a slave, as a member of an oppressed minority to, yes, argue that all people deserve freedom. He never said, oh, there's no such thing as race, we need to get beyond it. In fact, he was able to use it in very creative ways.
Those are the kinds of things you don't hear often about Frederick Douglass's trip to Ireland, for example.
Oh, yes. If you go to Ireland today, Fred, if you go to Belfast, you'll see murals in honor of Frederick Douglass. You'll also see murals and, well, not just murals, but school kids in some parts of Ireland know much more about the American Civil Rights Movement than many of our own kids here in the United States, unfortunately. And the reason that is that in the 1970s and 80s, many people in the Irish liberation struggle begin to study the civil rights movement in the U.S. for lessons on how to organize, on how to mobilize people at the grassroots, how to affect social change. And that's one of the reasons why U.S. civil rights history is taught probably more often outside of the U.S., in places like South Africa, Ireland, France, then sometimes it's taught in the U.S. Because, again, as Hassan is saying, there's this universal applicability in some of the central lessons on how to create social change, the notion that change doesn't begin from the top, as we're often taught, but it actually has to begin at the grassroots. And I think this is one of the reasons why President Obama excited so many people early on, because he knew that language. See, the language of a community organizer seems to be non-racial, but at the same time, it draws on these rich legacies of the civil rights movement. But also in the Latino community, early endorsers of Obama included people like Maria Elena Durazo, who's the head of the Los Angeles County Federation of Labor. And she came out of the UFW tradition with Cesar Chavez. And Chavez, of course, was a supporter of Dr. King, and Dr. King also supported the UFW. And that whole phrase, yes, we can, there, you know, the Spanish version of that is Si Se Puede, of course, and that was part of the farm workers' struggle. So that's why the Obama community organizing message, I think, resonated with so many people, even outside of the African-American community.
Hassan, is one of the lessons here that we really, in a sense, can't depend on government to initiate great social change, that it does have to come from community organizing, from people, from everyday people working together?
No, absolutely. I think it has to come from below, and I think it has to come from the people. I mean, it's the people who put pressure on government to get government to move and do the things that a government ought to do to ensure full equality for its citizens. And I think that is, you know, part of the great irony, and Paul makes a great point about the overseas appeal of the African-American freedom struggle, the international appeal of it. And we see it in the resonance of Obama's image and message even today. The great irony is that folk overseas, non-Americans, actually got the point of the African-American freedom struggle over the years, much more so than Americans. Paul mentioned Frederick Douglass, abolitionist, speaking overseas. Marcus Garvey's appeal overseas, the appeal of civil rights activists overseas, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, much more celebrated and embraced not only by people of color but by working class and poor people in Europe, in Latin America, in Asia.
Why much more do you think? Why much more so?
Well, the challenge that African Americans were posing was to the American government system. I mean, it was to the American status quo. So it was a very personal struggle in the sense that their opponents, the people, the community, the society in which they wanted to change was right here. And so to critique American society was to critique sort of white America. And so it's a very personal critique that requires some reflection. And then you don't always like what you see when you look in the mirror sometimes. And so there was a little bit more distance when you crossed the Atlantic that I think was important. But again, it's not just looking at what African Americans were doing for the sake of their struggle against inequality in America, but the message that they were saying. And it was a cult, it was a social political message, but it also had deep cultural expression. So Negro spirituals in the 1870s and 1880s, African American students from black colleges traveling overseas and literally singing before kings and queens. Freedom songs becoming the songs of solidarity. So we see it transmitted in different ways, but it definitely rang true with many people overseas.
Mm-hmm. Paul, let me ask you, we're saying the change here must, radical social change, big social change must come from the people. And we can't look to government to do that, ordinarily speaking. True also of the Obama administration, is that right?
It's absolutely true, Fred. Even before Obama was formally inaugurated and he was picking people to his cabinet, and there were some people who said, well, you know, he should have picked a more progressive cabinet. But it's interesting, if you looked at Franklin Roosevelt's cabinet in the early months of his administration, you had the same concerns that people in the progressive community had. But what was different in the 30s and the 60s, but even the 1860s for that matter, was you did have these large grassroots movements demanding social change. And we're beginning to see that on the ground in the United States. It's kind of a slow process, but some people suggest that all of the energy that was put into, say, Obama's campaign and some of the other political campaigns is going to begin to filter into, say, again, the labor movement. You saw African-American and Latino workers play a key role in a sit-down strike in Chicago, actually in December, in which Barack Obama actually endorsed. Now, that was a historic event that many people missed, the notion that you had a person who's going to become president of the United States endorsing an occupation factory strike in Chicago.
Tell us a little more about that. That did get by us, I think. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a group of predominantly Latino and African-American workers in Chicago in a glass factory. Their factory had closed down overnight. They made the argument that they were due severance pay and wages and benefits that were being denied to them. And so instead of leaving the factory, as most of us would do if our boss told us one day you no longer have a job, they stayed in the factory. And they organized there's a lot more to the story than that. They knew what was coming in advance, so they organized a really amazing publicity campaign to churches, to community organizations, and they made the argument that their employers, who, by the way, the company, the people at the top of the ownership hierarchy were, it was none other than Bank of America. And, of course, we have been, helping bail out Bank of America and many of these other investment banks as well. And so they made the argument that the employers, on a moral level, owed them their severance pay and their benefits, and they stayed in the factory. It was illegal. They were essentially, occupying someone else's private property. But it became kind of a cause célèbre in the Chicago area. A lot of Chicago Congress people went to the workers' defense, and then Obama heard about this, and he actually made a very powerful statement in favor of the occupation strike. And now the occupation strike is really what starts a lot of the progressive social changes in the 1930s. The Flint sit-down strikes in Flint, Michigan, in Atlanta, Georgia, and some of the other places. That, the unemployed movements in the 1930s, but also in the 60s, what made Dr. King's movement possible were people, many of the people that Hassan writes about in his work, these grassroots activists for SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, in places like Alabama and Georgia. They were the troops on the ground. They were the people who kept the voter mobilizations going. They were the people that ran the freedom schools. They were the people who delivered the masses to the March on Washington. So Martin Luther King could have this tremendous audience. But you have to have those people on the ground for change to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Paul makes a great point in that example. It really demonstrates the possibility and the prospect for change on the horizon. When we look back historically at the way government has treated or responded and reacted to labor when labor challenged capital, it wasn't to rush to their defense and even physically show up in solidarity or speak from a distance. It was to marshal forces, marshal troops, governors calling out the National Guard, mayors calling out the police, or turning a blind eye to private enforcement as they cracked down on labor's challenge to capital. So I think that really is a, for many people, was an important harbinger of what might come under the new administration if we have turned a corner, if you will, with regard to the relationship between ordinary people, working class people, and labor, and government and capital.
Reflections on Black history and the election of President Barack Obama with my guest today, Paul Ortiz, Associate Professor of History, Director of the Oral History Program at the University of Florida. Hassan Kwame Jeffries, Assistant Professor of History here at The Ohio State University. 614-292-8513. You can email brief comments or questions to openline at WOSU.org. Well, that's an interesting question that you raise, Hassan. Have we turned a corner in terms of the relationship between, you know, average American and their government? In other words, are we going to be less passive, more active? Well, we had Jim Wallace of Sojourners Movement on the show yesterday. He said he saw a spiritual revival leading to more activism in favor of abolishing poverty, in favor of the environment, et cetera. What are both of your thoughts on this one?
You know, I think it's yet to be determined. We shall see in the years to come. I think many people are more hopeful than they have been in the immediate past, but the jury is still out. We don't know yet. You know, one of the things, and Paul mentioned SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, one of the things that they did in the 60s was not just organize around public accommodations and to challenge Jim Crow. But by the mid-60s, moving into 65, 66, around the Voting Rights Act, they began to use the techniques that they organized to challenge Jim Crow to not only mobilize voters, but also to engage in political education. So they said it's not just a matter of being able to cast a ballot, but it's a matter of participating fully in the electoral process, which means being able at some point to run for office, to hold elected officials accountable. So what we saw with the Obama campaign mobilizing a diverse constituency, a rainbow coalition for the new millennium, if you will, is really only part of the equation. Now we have to see if that same mobilization translated into political interest, political education that will keep people politically engaged, to keep the pressure on government, both local, state, and national, to do the things that a responsive people's government would actually do.
Mm-hmm. Paul, your thoughts?
Well, I think Hassan is right. I think it gets back to a question you had raised earlier, Fred, about what is it about the African American freedom struggle and Black history that resonates internationally? And part of it is the Black political tradition, which is not a monolithic tradition. I mean, there are many different tendencies. If you talk about, you know, we mentioned Frederick Douglass, obviously having a different philosophy than someone like Ida B. Wells or even Marcus Garvey. But the kernel of that Black political tradition is this notion that government should not be my enemy. It should not be my problem. Government should actually work for me. Now, this is a complete reversal to the philosophy of Reaganism, for example, which really, for my entire adult life, has kind of been the ruling political philosophy of the United States of America, which is the notion that we have to get government off of our backs. Government is a problem more than the solution. The African-American political tradition argues exactly the opposite, that government should not be the problem. But it can only not be the problem if we find a way to mobilize and get government to do what we want it to do. That's not going to come by calling into late night radio television or radio shows and ranting, although that could be an important, you know, kind of getting the steam off of your chest or whatever. But Americans, I think, engage in a lot of activities today which we sometimes think are effective, but which in many ways are just, you know, a little more than complaining. And I think that's kind of what I grew up with. I mean, that's one of the things that drew me to Black history, was this notion that you could take responsibility for your political context. If you were enslaved, if you were oppressed, that there were things you could do collectively beyond just your individual sitting in front of a television. You could mobilize, you could organize a march, you could hold a union election. These are things that we learn from people in Black history, such as, you know, A. Philip Randolph, or Ida B. Wells, or, you know, Zora Neale Hurston. I mean, Black history is full of these amazing accounts of writers, of organizers, of artists who take on the deepest philosophical problems of their day in an active way. They're not passive about mm-hmm. them. They don't just sit back, but they engage in the broader society. And that's why I think, again, in Asia, in Africa, in Europe, people interpreted the Black freedom struggle in many ways as kind of an anti-colonial struggle in the 1950s and 60s, when many people in Asia and Africa were trying to free themselves from European colonialism. They kind of interpreted what was happening in the U.S. as an anti-colonial struggle, say the Montgomery bus boycott with Dr. King, or Malcolm X trying to come to France, and then, of course, the French government preventing him from stepping foot on French soil. The French government understood the danger of Malcolm X's message, this notion that people, that darker-skinned people across the entire world, but also working-class people ultimately should mobilize and organize together in solidarity. And these are the types of things, I think, that resonated with people throughout the world about Black history.
I guess that's one of the things that terrified certain power people about Malcolm X, is that he said, let's all get together here, people of all colors, of all ethnicities, and organize for our rights. And it seems to me the people in power understand that if you are merely complaining and calling into a talk show or sitting before your television set, that they can, that's a safety valve that powerful people can allow, because it doesn't really affect much. But people getting together and organizing, that's different, huh?
It is. Go ahead, Paul.
Oh, no, yeah. No, it's no accident, Fred, that we've seen the rise of these kinds of what I would call pseudo-political activities during an era in which we were told that government was the problem, and that all we could do was sit back and complain. And so it makes perfect sense that you've seen the rise of talk show, you know, late. I mean, I'm not saying that there's anything bad about, you know, late night talk radio. I mean, I listen to it. I've even called in on occasion, mm-hmm. but it's no substitute for real political activity.
What's that?
And the point of Malcolm X and his residence, and why he generated so much fear from government officials in the stateside is that he said explicitly that the African-American freedom struggle is not just a civil rights movement, but it's a human rights movement, mm-hmm. Which goes right back to the very first question that you asked. And the idea that, you know, we are a world body, that African-Americans belong to an African diaspora, that African-Americans belong to a global struggle against colonialism, that really resonated and really frightened a lot of people in the American government.
Reflections on Black history and the election of President Barack Obama this hour. And we'll be right back after these messages at WOSU 820 NPR News.
Has become a four-letter word, but with incentives like this, it's hard not to reach for the charge card.
The Discover Motiva card. When you pay your bill on time 6 months in a row, you get the next month's interest back as a cash reward.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Spend money, get a bonus. A new model for credit, next time on Marketplace from American Public Media.
That story and all the day's business headlines tonight at 6 on Marketplace. Now on WOSU 89.7 FM, NPR News and Classical Music. Marketplace at 6 o'clock tonight.
WOSU News reports on stories from around the state and in your backyard. We've definitely seen a spike in the number of applicants that we've received, and it is because people are being laid off.
Temporary agencies already are competing vigorously for placements.
You get a lot of phone calls every day from people, you know, I got laid off, do you have anything, do you have anything?
Get more from your news with the award-winning WOSU news team on WOSU 89.7 FM, NPR News, and classical music.
Taking a look at the weather forecast for today, cloudy skies and a chance of some snow later this afternoon, probably less than an inch of accumulation, and a high of 25. Cold tonight, cloudy, and a chance of snow with a low around 12 degrees. Currently 21 degrees in downtown Columbus, under sunny skies. And now, back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820, NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. Reflections on Black History and the election of President Barack Obama. Paul Ortiz, again, Associate Professor of History, Director of the Oral History Program at the University of Florida. He's the author of Emancipation Betrayed, The Hidden History of Black Organizing and White Violence in Florida from Reconstruction to the Bloody Election of 1920. Hassan Kwame Jeffries is Assistant Professor of History here at The Ohio State University. He's author of the forthcoming book, Bloody Lowndes. Now, Lowndes is Lowndes County in Alabama in the 1960s. Bloody Lowndes, Civil Rights and Black Power in Alabama's Black Belt. We're at 614-292-8513. You can email comments or questions to openline@wosu.org. When we look at the message of inclusiveness of President Barack Obama and his interest in all segments of the population, we can reflect back on the Reverend Jesse Jackson in his campaigns in 1984 and 1988, right, and how he sought that Rainbow Coalition and appealed, in fact, to white working class workers as one example. Huh?
Yeah, it's really amazing, Fred. I actually received some communication from Asian American political activists in California. I was working on a piece on, right after it was clear that Obama was going to be elected president. And one of the things that a lot of Asian American activists told me was that Jesse Jackson was really our entree into political organizing. In 83 and 84, he came to our communities and he said, we've got to forge unity between blacks and Asian Americans. And it can't just be a token thing. And we've got to get more Asian Americans active in mainstream American politics. And so for many Asian and Pacific Islander activists, especially in the West Coast, but also in the upper Midwest, in towns like Chicago or Detroit, they look back on that Rainbow Coalition and those 19, not just the 84 and 88 campaigns, but the whole broader, economic inclusiveness, economic justice, equality platform of the Rainbow Coalition as being this kind of renaissance, resurgence of Asian American politics. Mm-hmm. If you talk to someone like, say, Ron Daniels, who helped run Reverend Jackson's campaigns, he'll tell you that when Jesse Jackson would give a speech, he gave numerous speeches in all white communities, in all over the place. And he said the message really began to resonate. Initially, you'd have white folks who'd be very suspicious of a black man talking to them about running for president. But it was the message, I think, of economic equality, the fact that Jesse Jackson stood against, say, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which most Americans were opposed to in the early 90s, and the notion that he took a really progressive stance on a lot of these issues. Now, he wasn't, a flawless political candidate. There were many challenges, I guess you could say, in putting that coalition together. But at the same time, it did mobilize people. And remember, again, the 1980s was a pretty bleak period in terms of grassroots organizing in many ways. For many people, I know the Rainbow Coalition sometimes was their first foray into community organizing, into thinking about, hey, my problem isn't just an individual problem of being paid poor wages as a worker. The people I'm working right next to are being paid poor wages, too. So let's think about, organizing to change that.
Mm-hmm. It seems that Jesse Jackson, Hassan, is a bit discounted in recent years. He's faded a bit, of course, and people tend to maybe to underrate his accomplishment.
I think they have. And I think for two reasons, I think mainly. One, we tend to underestimate or forget, as Paul just pointed out, the really progressive nature of the platform that he stood on, the political platform that he ran under, if you will, in terms of environment, labor, labor issues, trade issues, as Paul just mentioned. I mean, these are things that then were sort of scoffed at, but now the Democratic Party has embraced. So in a sense, he was ahead of his time, and the times are just catching up to him, but the times have forgotten the really progressive nature of his politics at the time. That's one thing. The other thing is that we have in America, particularly in the media, we have looked at and sort of cast aspersions on African-American activists. Jesse Jackson obviously wasn't elected president, but he remained a critical voice out there in the African-American community, challenging injustice, which never goes over very well in the larger society, particularly when that voice is calling out and calling to the mat injustices revolving around race. So, one, he's challenging the system in new and radical ways.
Not a very popular thing to do, generally.
No. One, not to run for office the way he did on the kinds of issues that he did at that time. Mm-hmm. Two, not to in later on in the late 80s, early 90s, of course, to challenge or call people to task when others were sort of silent.
Did Barack Obama soft-pedal those issues a little bit in his campaign? I mean, he talked a lot about change, and he certainly would stand for some of the same issues that Jesse Jackson did, but I wonder if he said it less emphatically.
Well, he definitely – it was part – on a couple things. One, and Paul, please add when we get – as we get into this discussion – it was a part of his campaign strategy, explicit, to, particularly on the issue of race, not to mention it explicitly. I mean, that was – they made that decision very early on that they would identify – they would not run from the idea. You couldn't run from the name. You couldn't run from the image that he himself was a person of color, that he was an African-American. But they would not harp on it. They would not talk about it. They would sort of let it be.
That'd be a losing strategy if they did, if they had talked about
it. That was their idea. Yeah. That was the conclusion that they came to, that in these times, an individual African-American, an individual who happens to be African-American, if you can position him that way, if you can spend $750 million to get people to actually listen to what he's saying and see beyond what they see on the screen, then we have a chance to win. But if they associate him too closely to the African-American community, because many of the dominant stereotypes about people of color still persist as a group, then he runs into trouble. So they purposefully downplayed and did not talk about certain issues in certain ways.
Mm-hmm. Paul, your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with Hassan. And the only thing I would add to it is that was definitely the strategy at the upper echelons of the Democratic Party and specifically the Obama campaign. I think as we got closer to the street level, to the people who went door to door in communities, to the people who handed out flyers, I mean, that's where you saw a much more diverse kind of strategy emerging, and one in which, you know, race and class, gender equity issues became much more acute and much, you know, they were the frontline headline issues, if you will, at the grassroots. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily at the top. I mean, it's no mistake that the first real act of the Obama administration is to sign on in favor of pay equity for women, right? To add women to the Civil Rights Act. Again, the fact that African Americans struggled for the Civil Rights Act, it came out of the racial struggles, but it has universal applicability. And now women are covered under this critical part of the act. So again, if you went to the grassroots, you saw that in terms of the percentages of people voting for President Obama, 96% of the African American community of African Americans who voted cast their votes for Obama. Mm-hmm. About 67% of Latinos cast their votes for Obama. About the same percentage of Asian Americans cast their votes for Obama. And I think if you went into each of those communities, you see people. I mean, the genius of Obama in many ways is that he leaves himself open to different interpretations. And so different communities, different people, different demographic groups can claim him. And really the other part of his genius, I have to say, is that he doesn't tell people this is what we're going to do. A lot of people complain during the campaign, why isn't he more concrete? Why doesn't he, you know, list, you know, 10 items that he is absolutely going to work on?
Yes.
Well, the reason was, again, the background of being a community organizer, harkening back to the African-American political tradition, is leadership doesn't mean that I tell you what you need to do to change your life. Leadership means we sit down at the table like people did in the freedom schools in, you know, Mississippi in the mid-1960s, and let's talk about what curriculum we need. Let's talk about what political change we need. And so it's more of a facilitating strategy than I'm your leader strategy, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Hassan.
Yeah, you make a great point, because that falling back on or drawing upon that community organizing strategy of the people, let the people lead, if you will, created space for two types of conversations to carry on. One at the grassroots. Paul mentioned where, you know, African Americans, 96% up to 98%, depending upon where you were, 99% African Americans voting for Barack Obama. Those conversations, I said earlier, you sort of had on the national level, Obama sort of not talking explicitly about issues that we identify or discussing them explicitly in terms of race. But on the grassroots level, when folk were knocking on doors in community meetings and encouraging each other to vote for Obama, those conversations were taking on very explicit they were made in very explicit racial terms. It was very clear that this was an African-American candidate. It was very clear that this was a part of the continuation of the African-American freedom struggle. So that space was very important. Which enabled these two different conversations to take place. And I think Paul is you're absolutely right when you say that Obama, not being vague but being general, allowed for folk to make these various interpretations and feel comfortable and say, you know what, I think he is going to work in this direction. He does recognize this. Even though he may not be saying it explicitly, because we understand the context of the political times in which we live.
Mm-hmm. Hassan Kwame Jeffries is Assistant Professor of History here at The Ohio State University. Paul Ortiz, Associate Professor of History at the University of Florida. 614-292-8513 for your thoughts. Emails to openline@wosu.org. Hassan, in fact, you did some canvassing for the Obama campaign, and you wrote a piece about it. You went to a relatively impoverished white working-class neighborhood here, huh?
I did. You know, sort of the last day of the election day, in a neighborhood not too far from where my wife and I live. And it was a an impoverished working-class, underclass white neighborhood. And my wife and I are sort of knocking on doors, just as foot soldiers like anybody else who was sort of volunteering for the campaign that day. And we were really surprised, pleasantly surprised, didn't really know what the reaction would be. And even on election day, as I was sort of knocking on doors, I had no idea what the outcome would be.
Mm-hmm.
But it was quite an experience, and an experience that so many people shared. And in the end, it was a moving experience to see people, particularly sort of young white folk, young white people, who, you know, were fully supporting Obama, folk who had never voted before, really, you know, for me, sort of turned the corner in my mind, saying, you know what, this is really bigger than even I understood it to be.
What did that mean to you when you realized that white working class Americans were supporting Obama? Some of them were.
You know, we heard a lot about hope and possibility. It was this idea that people are actually catching up, that they're really getting it, that the society as a whole, you know, even though 50 million people still voted against Barack Obama, but that we are, if we haven't changed the corner, we're at least peeping around it. that folk really are understanding that we are in the same boat, that it isn't so much about sort of personal prejudice. It's about the structures that we have to challenge and that people are affected by it in different ways, regardless of race and regardless of class. And so to see folk who weren't politically engaged before rally behind a person who was a person of color for president and be fully supportive of him and engage in coalition, not just to vote for him, but with other people of color, other working class people, was something I didn't think I would ever see.
Putting aside any prejudices that they might have had.
Well, yes, and hopefully it becomes a transformative experience. But, I mean, we can't underestimate the power of $750 million that went into the campaign, because what that did for Barack Obama was make him a person, not just a caricature, not just a racial caricature, but an actual person. Now, the hope is that that then becomes or what we see in him as a person, those good qualities that we admire in him, that we begin to see in other people of color. And that's what I began to see that evening.
Mm-hmm. Paul, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's amazing when we think of Election Day. I mean, I was just that whole day, I was on edge, and I had no idea what was going to happen. I think like many of us, and I didn't engage in canvassing. I know my wife was very active, and she would come home every day, and she would say, you know, I had a conversation with someone, they really hinted that they could not vote, you know, for a black man, even though they had been lifelong Democrats. But they were thinking about it, and you could see, you know, she would say you could see them mentally wrestling with this this dilemma, if you will. And I also think that it's important for us, you know, it's important for us to not necessarily see history as this real progressive thing that where things always get better, let's say race relations. You know, the Greek historians like Herodotus, for example, taught us that, you know, history can be a record of improvements, but it also can, it can be full of victories, but also it can involve defeats as well. And if you think of people like Frederick Douglass, who at one point in his life felt like he was going to really be there at the moment when America embraced equality, and he went through the Civil War experience. And but then at the end of his life in the 1890s, he died really in many ways broken and just, you know, mentally wore out because he saw the society turn towards Jim Crow, towards lynching. And so on election night, I guess I had mixed feelings. There was a sense of elation, but also I thought about all of these people who, you know, millions who had fought for freedom and justice, but who couldn't be there on election night. You know, I thought of people like Lemuel Haynes, who was an American Revolutionary War hero. He fought at Ticonderoga, at Bunker Hill, but towards the end of his life, he was a Christian minister. He lost his congregation because his church decided that a black man could not lead a predominantly white congregation. Barack Obama came too late for people like Lemuel Haynes. Or, you know, I also thought about Thomas Paine, probably the greatest American revolutionary. And Paine, his first public tract, even before Common Sense, was a pamphlet denouncing slavery.
Interesting.
Even before the American Revolution broke out. And in many ways, people like Thomas Paine and Lemuel Haynes, they were embarrassing figures for us because they did the right thing, right? They were opposed to racial oppression back at a time now when people say, oh, well, that's just the way things were back then. But you always have people like Paine, like Wendell Phillips, like Ida B. Wells and others. You know, they may have lived before their time, but they were the building blocks that made November 2008 and the election of Obama possible. And I think, you know, I'm hoping that with the election of Barack Obama, beyond even the political dimensions, I'm hoping that it will encourage people to see African-American history as a centerpiece of American history and the history of Western civilization, and not just something that happens, you know, in February or something that's in a bracket, but really it's at the centerpiece of of our experience.
I mean, there are just so many people who fought for African-American rights and, as you point out, for human rights. And some of the names forgotten that just shouldn't be forgotten.
Right.
I think both of your books, by the way, Paul, yours, Emancipation Betrayed, and Hassan, your forthcoming book, Bloody Lounge, bring to mind some of those names that otherwise might be forgotten, and it's a shame that they are.
And as you mentioned both books, I think it's not necessarily a coincidence, and we shouldn't forget that in the titles of both books is the word bloody.
Yeah.
One of the things that I think helps explain why so many people in the African-American community felt this election so deeply was because they understood what African-Americans had been up against for so long. I mean, Jim Crow was violent, and it was violent not just because a water fountain is dangerous. It was violent because those who challenged power faced the prospect of death. It was – you risked your life attempting to vote, whether it was in Florida in 1920 or it was in Alabama in 1965. It was a dangerous prospect. And so to go from that to from being risking your life simply to try to register before you could even get to the ballot box to being able to cast a ballot for an African-American to become president of the United States is a long journey that obviously many people thought they would never be around long enough to see.
When you think of all the names of all the people who in fact did give their lives in the civil rights and human rights struggle here in the United States and around the world, and so many, I mean, you could have a huge memorial like the Vietnam Veterans Memorial with all of those names of people around the world. Huh?
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yes, Paul.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, you know, and you know, even not just people who lost their lives or who were lynched or killed during slavery times, but I think the people who waged these quiet struggles, you know, you think of leaders of neighborhoods, you think of again, community organizers who, you know, started, you know, who were active in anti-poverty campaigns in the 1960s. You know, Hassan mentioned earlier that African-Americans frequently, for some reason or the other, get vilified for their activities. I mean, imagine what it's like to be black in the society even today. I mean, you can open a newspaper almost every day of the week, you turn to the editorial page, and you can read a commentator completely trashing your community and blaming black people for society's problems. It, increasingly, Latinos are facing this as well. And imagine what that does to your psyche day after day, year after year. And then at the same time, knowing that you are not the problem. In fact, if people would listen to you, that things could get a lot better. You know,
mm-hmm.
I think of people like Carter G. Woodson, for example. Dr. Woodson was the founder of Black History Month. And his organization is still around, the Association for the Study of African American Life and History. It's not a militant activist organization, so to speak, but it's an organization of educators who believe in the importance of black history. And they do, again, these quiet types of activities. They get black history into elementary schools, into, you know, community education projects. And you've had these people all throughout American history. And, again, the hope is that now, instead of them being so, you know, somehow vilified, that people will come to respect their work and actually embrace it as part of this new inclusivity.
So often the powerless people get blamed for really conditions that are the actions, the result of actions of people in power.
Yeah, it's something that, I mean, it's sad, but it's easier to, I mean, as we've seen with the Wall Street scandals and the breakdown of the economy, it's always easier, Fred, to blame people who are lower on the food chain than you are. It's much more difficult for us to look up at the top and come up with a critique. It's easier. In fact, you've had some people who've been blaming the economic downturn on poor people. I mean, poor people are incredibly, you know, vilified in the society. But I think right now we have a chance to kind of turn things around. In Florida, in a couple of weeks, I'm speaking at a memorial for the survivors of the Rosewood racial massacre that occurred in 1923. You know, I'm sure that many of your listeners watched the film that came out a few years ago
Yes.
on Rosewood. What's interesting is the juncture we're at now. There is one survivor of the Rosewood racial massacre who's living with us, who's still living. They all have passed away. What the organizers of this memorial are doing is they're using the memorial not simply to talk about the people who are victimized, the African Americans, but they're also using it to honor the white people who helped African Americans escape from the massacre. There were a few white families who actually harbored African Americans in a way that harkening back to the Underground Railroad in the 1840s and 1850s. And so this notion is use Rosewood to open a new dialogue, which we desperately need, on race relations. But it's a really poignant moment in our history. We have people like, Ann Nixon Cooper, 106 years old, who voted for Obama, who has seen so many things in her life, who understands, I think, we have a long way to go.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you both, if based on your extensive research, you'd bring up some names that of people who fought in the civil rights and human rights struggle, names that we might not immediately recognize, but that you know very well.
Well, I think it's part of our task as historians to make sure to call the names of the people who did so much, who never received the press and publicity at the time, to call the names of the ordinary folk who did so much, who did extraordinary things under really extreme and trying circumstances. It's important not to forget that Martin Luther King did not march alone, that the people pushed King rather than King pulling the people. So it's incumbent upon us, not just as historians who study African American history, but really as historians of the American experience, to call the names of those people, to document their experiences, those ordinary everyday people who made such a big difference. And let me just add, that becomes so important in this day and age because it's those people who we are able to see ourselves in. Sometimes people ask me, well, how come young people do not embrace Martin Luther King like they once did?
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, Martin Luther King is no longer a person. He's a deity. He's frozen on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. He's not touchable anymore. Part of the reason why I think Obama resonated so much with young people is that he was still human. It was a brother who played basketball, who had a BlackBerry and listened to music on his iPhone. That made him human. We've lost touch with the humanity of the people of the past who made a big difference. So if we can't recover the humanity of folk like King, then perhaps we can recover the humanity of those ordinary men and women, black and white, brown and white, who made such an extraordinary difference.
Yeah, and who continue to do that. Paul, here in the final minute and a half or so, your thoughts.
Well, I think I'm very excited right now, Fred, because I think that the election of Obama has really raised an interest, a new profound interest in African-American history. And, my phone is ringing off the hook. I mean, people want me to speak about, where did Obama come from? But even beyond that, who made his triumph possible? And it allows us to go back to the 19th century and the 18th century. Now, like Hassan is saying, to try to humanize these historical kind of icons, people like Frederick Douglass. And I think we're going to see an enhanced interest in American history. And I think that this really can only be a good thing. And I look forward to, to participating in that. And, but again, I hope we don't forget the basic political, historical message out of this election, which is that, people have the power if we decide to take it as a society, but it has to come through organization. And that is the central, political lesson of African-American history.
Mm-hmm. Paul Ortiz is Associate Professor of History, Director of the Oral History Program at the University of Florida. He's the author of Emancipation Betrayed, The Hidden History of Black Organizing and White Violence in Florida from Reconstruction to the Bloody Election of 1920. Hassan Kwame Jeffries, Assistant Professor of History here at The Ohio State University, author of the forthcoming Bloody Lounge, Civil Rights and Black Power in Alabama's Black Belt. Thank you both for being here this hour.
Thank you very much, Fred.
Thank you, Fred. It was really fun.
When we come back, why are so many of us overweight. It's a global obesity epidemic, according to nutritionist Barry Popkin. After the news, listener-supported WOSU, WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.